So I've served on the Unitarian Universalist Association's Board of Trustees for almost 6 years now. I expire this General Assembly in June, and I'm ready to go gently into that good night. It's been an incredibly valuable experience, and frankly, I wouldn't trade it for anything. I've learned a lot. I've developed some skills. I've learned more than I ever thought I would know about Unitarian Universalism. But we are, of course, a democracy, and democracies are messy, so tightly bound they are with human strengths and human failings. And it does take a certain kind of stomach to see how the sausage is made and then get up the next morning and eat a large breakfast. But boy, if I've had any ambivalence, what a privilege it was. 2 weeks ago, I got to go with the Unitarian Universalist Association Board to represent our movement at the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights March in Selma. It was an absolutely profound experience. So I probably live closer to history than most folks in my heart, even in my everyday life. But to actually be there in that historic setting and to understand its connection to the past, to the present, and the future was just overwhelming. And that's all a way of saying I don't actually have a sermon for you today. The fact of the matter, this was such a huge experience that I'm still processing it. As an introvert, I'll probably have something to say about this next month. But what I did want to share with you was just what happened to me, because the experiences themselves were just so unusual and so rich. So the UUA board was one of the groups that received that original telegram from Martin Luther King Jr. asking for folks to come to Selma. Of course, the hope was that if religious persons, and frankly, if white persons, were to come to Selma, that would help curtail some of that official violence. The UUA board was actually in session when they received the telegram, and they immediately decided to disband only to reconvene in official session in Selma. And so when we learned about the plans for the 50th anniversary march, we knew we would have to convene as a UUA board in Selma for the occasion. So we arrived in Birmingham on a Thursday morning. Selma itself is an incredibly small town. There really are no accommodations there. So to stay in a hotel, one really has to choose Birmingham or Montgomery. And the trip from Birmingham to Selma is actually 90 miles, so there really is nothing very proximate to Selma. So the first thing we did was hop in our bus and make that trip from Birmingham to Selma. I'm so glad, actually, that we had that 90-mile trip to make. It helped me get into a different kind of mindset. That entire trip was through the most poverty-stricken parts of rural Alabama that you can imagine. And to my urban northern eyes, this was an entirely new landscape. The physical landscape was different, all this scrappy pine. But of course, it was the human landscape that struck me the most. These incredibly ramshackle houses just kind of plopped down into those scraggly pine forests with junk all around them and roofs caving in. I was so glad for that experience, for it strikes me that if we're going to understand anything about hatred, we need to begin with the kind of desperation that only poverty can breed. But of course, I knew too the contrast between my experience and what was in the past. There we were in our board bus, our plush board bus with the onboard bathroom and air conditioning and plush seats, traveling from Birmingham to Selma in complete safety and comfort. That very same road, as well as the state highway similar to it, from Selma to Montgomery, had been for civil rights workers for a very long time a place of complete danger. It was indeed Violet Leoza, one of the Unitarian Universalists who was killed in the civil rights struggle. It was on the road, the state highway from Selma to Montgomery, where she was ambushed by a group of KKK men who killed her on the spot because she was helping to shuttle civil rights workers back and forth between the cities. So to travel on that road in complete safety was an interesting and sobering experience. So when we pull into Selma, on the outskirts of Selma, the very first thing we saw was a used car lot. But it wasn't any used car lot. It was Bama Motors. Bama Motors is a used car lot that's run by the man who beat Reverend James Reeb to death. He is still running that car lot in that neighborhood where most of his clientele are African American. There were three men who were charged with the murder of James Reeb. All of them were acquitted by their all-white jury. That, of course, just brought home how desperately important voters' rights was in the context of that Selma march. At that time in Selma, there were 14,000 African American residents who would have theoretically been eligible to register as voters. Only 300 had managed to do so because of the widespread discrimination around it. And so consequently, there wasn't a single person in that county who had had a trial by anything other than an all-white jury. From Bama Motors, we went to the place on the sidewalk outside of Walker's Cafe where James Reeb was beaten. He and Clark Olson and Orloff Miller had had dinner in that cafe, one of the few places where you could have dinner as a civil rights worker, one of the few integrated restaurants. They'd had dinner and then they were walking down the sidewalk when a group of three white men attacked them and started to beat Reverend Reeb and calling him the N-word. He was immediately unconscious, but he was still alive, and the task then became how to get medical care for him. The white hospital was not receiving civil rights workers. And the black infirmary was totally overwhelmed, still even caring for the victims of Bloody Sunday. How to care for him? They took him to the black infirmary. The doctor there immediately recognized the severity of his head injuries and said his only chance of survival would be to get him to the larger hospital in Birmingham. That meant traveling that treacherous road, where people were in wait. But that's what they did. They put him in a car because there was no ambulance that would agree to take him. They put him in a car and drove that 90 miles from Selma to Birmingham, all the while being followed by members of the KKK. They were able to deliver James Reeb to the hospital in Birmingham, but it was too late. Too much time had elapsed since his injury, and the doctors there could do very little but make him comfortable until he died the next day. We saw that place on the sidewalk outside of what was Walker's Cafe and is now an abandoned building. We continued our tour of Selma as if that weren't enough. Our next stop was the Brown Memorial Chapel. That's the Baptist chapel that Martin Luther King had used as headquarters for the Voting Rights March there in Selma. And immediately was clear to me why he would have used that chapel. So on one hand, it was a very beautiful building, and of course it was just overwhelming seeing the pulpit from which Martin Luther King Jr. said so many of his amazing things. But for me, the most moving thing about that chapel was its surrounding. Brown Chapel is entirely surrounded by a public housing project, and so it made kind of the perfect tent camp for the civil rights movement. It was impossible to come and go from Brown Chapel without those neighbors noticing exactly what was going on. And indeed, when the civil rights workers came down from the north, they stayed almost entirely with families inside of that housing project. So for me, it seemed that the sacred space of that chapel wasn't just that church building, but that entire neighborhood. And indeed, while I was moved by the chapel, what amazed me the most was seeing the lawn out front of the chapel, and just being able to see in my mind's eye all the people who were treated there on the lawn from their injuries from Bloody Sunday. We left Brown Chapel and headed to the First Baptist Tabernacle, where there was going to be a worship service honoring all the martyrs of the civil rights movement. What an amazing building that is. Really, I mean, it earns the name Tabernacle. It's this amazing kind of Grecian building on a street corner. But immediately it was clear we were in another kind of universe, because this building is on a street corner and it has two identical grand entrances on each street. And of course, this was from the late 19th century when this building was built. And the most radical thing that those folks could think to do would be to have entrances for white people and African Americans that were separate but actually equal, when everything else they knew was separate and unequal. So just the building itself spoke such a tale. But we walked into the building and we were given our assigned pews, and I was thrilled to realize we were immediately in front of Mrs. Boynton. Now, Mrs. Boynton actually has a first name, Amelia, but I wouldn't dare use it. This woman is royalty. Mrs. Boynton is 103 years old right now, and she's one of the most distinguished veterans of the Civil Rights Movement. She had had the foresight. In 1963, her husband passed away of natural causes. And at that point, she was already very dedicated to the cause of civil rights. And she realized, even in her personal grief, she realized that her husband's memorial service would be a good occasion for having a mass organizational meeting, because people gathering for the memorial service wouldn't excite too much attention from the authorities. So she actually transformed her husband's memorial service into that organizing meeting, one of the first and one of the most powerful. Lots of people describe Mrs. Boynton as having been incredibly hospitable and having fed the entire civil rights movement. But the fact of the matter is, what she did was far more complicated than that. You might even know her. It's one of the pictures of Bloody Sunday that stands out in the media is a picture of a woman lying unconscious on the bridge. That was Amelia Boynton. She was beaten to the point of unconsciousness, only to the next day get up and continue her work as organizer. Just to say two more things about this amazing woman, she was one of those 300 people who had managed to get herself registered to vote, when registering to vote as an African American meant having to pass the most ridiculous civil exam you could possibly imagine. And she also had the guts, she ran for senator from the state of Alabama in 1964. Wow. So we met Mrs. Boynton, and of course, she was kind of God to us, to put it mildly. And then sitting behind us was all of James Reeb's family. And this was the first time that they've gathered and gone to Selma since James Reeb was killed. His sister was there, his children were there, and his grandchildren were all there in the pew right behind us. Well, it was time for the service. And on the chancel were all the heroes of the civil rights movement, all the African American pastors, and then all the pastors from the church, from churches in Selma right then and there. And then there was one kind of outlier, which was our own Unitarian Universalist moderator, Jim Key. What a thrill to see all those people, and then Jim Key, who was able to say a few words during the service. But I was so grateful for the service. Not only did it provide a dignified memorial for those who had died in the cause, but it made the point that this isn't just about history. Bernice King, Martin Luther King's daughter, spoke and talked about how in 50 years ago, the Supreme Court was on the side of progress and equal rights, and how now that's not the case. And Jeremiah Wright, Obama's own controversial pastor, gave an incredibly moving sermon about how, in his opinions, black bodies matter, but lives do not. It was an amazing worship service. And because this was the South, it lasted 3.5 hours long. And you know what? I wasn't bored for a single second. So we went back to Birmingham. We spent the next 2 days with the Unitarian Universalist Living Legacy Conference, which was a group of people who were gathering specifically to understand this event in the context of Unitarian Universalism. And we heard some amazing things. I heard from Clark Olson. Clark Olson was with James Reeb when he was beaten. Clark Olson actually held Jim Reeb's hand until he realized he felt Jim Reeb's consciousness go from his body. And Clark Olson had amazing things to say about his own reaction to what happened when James Reeb died. He, of course, was gratified that James Reeb received a lot of attention when he died. Lyndon Johnson himself called his widow. Members of Congress made their own statements. Martin Luther King, of course, gave a eulogy for Jim Reeb. But all Clark Olson noticed was the difference between the attention that Jim Reeb got and his family got versus the attention that Jimmie Lee Jackson had got. Jimmie Lee Jackson was the young African-American man who had died and who had been the impetus for wanting to have a march from Selma to Montgomery. His family didn't receive a call from President Johnson. And indeed, even Viola Lezu didn't receive the same kind of attention as James Reeb. There's nothing like the intersection of oppressions. Even to this day, if you look up some things about Viola Lezu, there's a lot of criticism of her for abandoning her family in order to go on this march. And there's even stuff out there about how promiscuous she was because she rode in cars with strange men. It's amazing, isn't it, how many oppressions we have and how they can overlap. But it was touching to hear Clark Olson. And the uplift of that particular time for me was hearing C.T. Vivian speak. C.T. Vivian is someone that Obama has called the world's greatest preacher. And I'm going to go ahead and add my vote to that. He is one of the few surviving close members of Martin Luther King's inner circle. He had been president of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee at the time of the Voters' Rights March. But what a presence this man has. And I've noticed it before. I've noticed it before primarily in the clergy who had this experience in Selma. This incredible gravitas, this incredible worldly wisdom that's grounded in this unshakable sense of compassion. And so C.T. Vivian just had a conversation with us. We were just chatting back and forth, C.T. Vivian and 400 Unitarian Universalists. And someone finally had the guts to ask C.T. Vivian the question that was on many Unitarian Universalist minds, which is, we knew we were gathering there in Selma with so much in common with the people there, but there was a little bit of anxiety. Would those more traditional Christians think that we're heretics? So someone actually asked that question of C.T. Vivian, and he gave the most beautiful response I could imagine. He described for himself what is the essence of Christianity. And he said for him, the essence of Christianity is not the worship of Jesus. It's simply the practice of love. And he said, I see you all practicing love. We are surely of the same faith. It was a very moving experience. So Sunday morning arrived, and it was time for the big march. So the first thing we did was go to Brown Chapel for worship. What an amazing worship that was. Al Sharpton was there. Jesse Jackson was there. I'm sorry, I got a little celebrityized on it. I know that's the most shallow possible reaction to the experience, but it was hard to ignore. So we sat there on Sunday morning for the worship, and Peter Morales, the president of our Unitarian Universalist Association, was introduced, and he had a chance to say just a few words. He chose exactly the right words. He simply said, "We are your partners forever." It was beautiful. We had that worship in Brown Chapel. There were several hundred of us inside of the chapel, but there were thousands of people on the street watching this service on a jumbotron. So we left Brown Chapel, and then at that point, those of us on the board broke up because we had different assignments. We had different worshiping communities we were meant to go to and extend our greetings to. So I'm really embarrassed to say I felt cranky about my assignment. So my assignment was to the Selma Community Church, and it was the only church on the list that didn't have a history in the civil rights movement. It's a recently gathered church. So I was feeling all cranky that I didn't get to go to one of the great historical chapels. And then I was feeling all cranky because it's the only place in Selma where the music's no good. I mean, we've gotten used to a standard here, right? So this is a small community church, and the music is, they have karaoke machine. I kid you not. They have a karaoke machine, and they sing R&B standards, but they changed the lyrics to be generically Christian. I mean, it's the most remarkable thing. And, you know, if you need to amuse yourself sometime, just, you know, pick out different R&B titles and imagine how to make them generically Christian. You know, there's some titles that work better than others. And, you know, some of the sexier R&B tunes, like Made Christian, is just weird and creepy. So I'm feeling all cranky about this. When I realized that I was exactly in the place that I needed to be, I asked the folks I met there about the history of that church. It's only a handful of years old, but it's the only church in Selma that's truly integrated. And it was. Everything was integrated, from the music to the clergy team. Everything I saw there was just this perfect model of integration. But when I realized that my job there was to hear the witness of people who were members of that congregation who had that very week and that very day experienced acts of hatred directed against them, I knew I was in the right place, even if it was a hard place. I met a young African-American woman who showed me the rock that had been thrown in her car that very morning, complete with a scroll, which she showed me, from the KKK. I felt such shame as a Northern liberal that I didn't realize. I mean, the KKK sounds to me like something historic. To realize that there were people still acting under that banner and distributing that literature was just remarkable to me. And other folks made similar testimony. There were a number of KKK pamphlets that were plastered throughout Selma on that day. And there was even one big billboard, a billboard with a picture of one of the more famous grand wizards of the KKK, saying, "Keep the scare on." So I was glad to be in that space, and know how, in so many ways, so much has changed, and yet not nearly enough. So my next task was a happier one. It was to once again cross Selma. I've crossed Selma about a dozen times. It was really a remarkable experience doing that. There were so many friendly people in the street, and it was just such an air of celebration. But I crossed Selma again to be at the park on the outskirts of town, which was going to be the receiving pad for the Unitarian Universalist invasion. So I and some fellow board members arrived in the park, and it was this completely empty urban park. And then before I knew it, there were about 100 Unitarian Universalists from local congregations there, all in our bright yellow Standing on the Side of Love t-shirt, so there was no mistaking who they were. And so these first 100 people assembled in the park, and then we waited to receive the buses. And, you know, not on time, but whatever. Not on time, the 15 full busloads of similarly yellow-shirted Unitarian Universalists arrived in the park, and we all assembled and began to march to Brown Chapel for the beginning of the real march. So, wow, and the real march began. I have a couple observations about that. One is, I have never been anywhere in my whole life where the name recognition of Unitarian Universalism was perfect and universally positive. When people introduced themselves to me, and when I introduced myself to people and explained I was a Unitarian Universalist and a minister and a part of the board, I was like cranking up for the next part, right? Which is the, what is Unitarian Universalism? I never had to go to the next part. And people said the most amazing things to me. One woman said, "Oh my gosh, yes, Unitarians, you were with us 50 years ago." Other people I met said, "Yes, Unitarian Universalists, James Reeb's people." And there was this instant recognition. But the thing that blew me away the most was just as I was crossing Edward Pettus Bridge, these people noticed my name tag. They were so excited by my Unitarian Universalist name tag that they took a photograph of it. I've never experienced anything like that. I thought our name recognition in Boston was good. Selma is where our name is gold, really. It was amazing. The other amazing thing about the march was we were 70,000 people, and none of this was organized in any way. There were very few official organizers, And there was almost no police or National Guard presence, which I think was actually an excellent decision. But that meant there were 70,000 of us who had to just kind of figure out how to get ourselves into formation and get ourselves over the bridge. And you know what? It worked beautifully. Nobody was cranky. Nobody was cranky, even though, this wasn't a march like other marches I've been on. People hadn't, both because of, I think, a respect for the dignity of the occasion and also the poverty of the area. You know, there weren't porta potties. There weren't people selling water. There weren't T-shirts and all the kinds of things that we might associate with different kinds of marches. So even without all those amenities, people were just so incredibly good about figuring out how to get 70,000 people over the bridge. And one day, I'm not going to do it now because it will take a full hour, one day I'll explain to you the brilliant grassroots organization that took place around the restrooms that did exist. Just saying, I've never seen such a brilliant expression of crowd intelligence as what happened there. But anyway, I mean, the whole thing was just remarkable. And so throughout those 70,000 people, you could see there were about 600 of us Unitarian Universalists, so you could see our bright yellow shirts sprinkled everywhere. And what an amazing collection of humanity. There were, I think, at least 300 or 400 African-American Masons who marched arm-linked in full white-tail evening attire. It was the most remarkable thing I've ever seen. There were beauty queens marching in formation. Now, I'm used to parades with beauty queens. These were beauty queens marching in formation. And, you know, they deserve a special medal, complete with the heels to go with it. The ACLU was there. I mean, it was absolutely remarkable. So at one point during the march, I got separated from all the other Unitarian Universalists because this is just this kind of amazing sea of humanity figuring its own thing out. So, you know, I'm not a scientist, but there was some kind of randomization thing going on there, right? So I was away from anyone I knew and from any yellow shirt that I could see except up in the distance. And I remember the feeling, which was the feeling I had the entire day, which was, I don't know how else to describe it. I hope this doesn't sound trivializing. But I felt so relaxed. I realized that day, I had nothing other to do than keep showing up in places. So my preparation for the march had only been dry cleaning my gray suit and polishing my dress shoes. Well, we had a long conversation about what to wear. Long conversation about what the UUA board should wear to Selma. Should we wear our yellow shirts? Should we? But it was finally the wisdom of the group that I think was exactly right, that it would be respectful to dress as Martin Luther King and the other clergy dressed at that time. And I have to say, when you see those pictures of the original march, I love how when everyone is dressed in kind of Sunday best, you can't tell the differences between people. You can't tell who's lay, who's clergy, you can't tell who's Protestant, you can't tell who's Catholic, you can't even tell class. And I just think there's a beauty to that kind of feeling. But anyway, we decided we would dignify it up and march in suits and dress shoes. So anyway, I felt this great relaxation knowing that my job was to just take my name tag and my dress shoes to different places in Selma. You know, I think a lot about what the future of Unitarian Universalism, Universalist activism is. And I think this experience of knowing how to be a foot soldier is an incredibly valuable one for us. We Unitarian Universalists do a lot of virtues very easily, but humility is maybe not our top one. And we usually have, you know, some ideas about how things should be done. For me, I wonder if the future of our movement isn't exactly just lending our bodies to movements that we want to have as our allies. And just showing up. So finally, there was the moment we crossed the bridge and got back on our comfortable little bus and rode back to Birmingham. But oh, the processing on that bus. So we started, each of us describing what had happened to us during Sunday worship. And you won't be surprised. So the first person shared, oh, my preacher was the best. My preacher at my Sunday worship, he went on and on about how we've crossed this bridge, but there are bridges yet to cross. And then the next person shared, my preacher was the best, and he gave this excellent sermon about how there are bridges left to cross. And then so finally, Chris Walton, who is the editor of our UU News magazine, said, you know, in a slightly joking but ever so slightly cynical tone, you know, yes, preachers are going to work the bridge theme. You know, you have an obvious bridge theme. A preacher is going to seize on that and go with it. So we laughed about that for a while because, of course, it was the obvious thing to do. But you know what? It was exactly the right thing too, because that's the question that lingers as we leave Selma. It was the question that lingered after we left Selma for the first time. What other bridges are we going to cross, and how are we going to do it? And I have to say, I don't have a really explicit imagination of what the next step is exactly, but I hope it's something like that. I hope it's like that experience I had of just marching, knowing that there were people ahead of me, and my job was to follow. And I think, of course, of the words of Martin Luther King, who not only said, this is the responsibility of all Americans, but he said, faith is taking a first step, even if you can't see the whole staircase. I think that's the lesson that awaits us as Unitarian Universalists, and I can't wait to see where it carries us.